From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, is California about to change course when it comes to bilingual education in public schools? We'll hear two sides of the issue. We'll also talk to John Hernandez, another challenger in the heated race to be the next representative in California's 21st Congressional District. That and a talk with author and historian Gary Noy in his new book, Sierra Stories, which chronicles life in the Sierra Nevada mountains from the gold rush to the present day. That's coming up a little later in our program. But first, when you think of Fresno State, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Maybe Bulldog football, award-winning wines, or acclaimed programs in business and creative writing? Well, those would all be correct, but there's probably one thing that didn't immediately pop into your head: water conservation. But as FM 89's Carrie Klein reports, there's an effort underway at the sprawling campus to change that.
One of Fresno State's newest additions is a broad, brown, mulchy patch of land in front of the Science 2 building. Gardening specialist Fortunato Garcia leads volunteers with shovels to a lumpy mound.
All right, so we'll put one fertilizer tab here, one there.
Before long, this patch will be more than mulch. It's the start of a WaterWise demonstration garden. Ground supervisor Michael Frick points out the low water bulbs and saplings that are being planted.
Right here is a bunch of sage. Now, on the other stuff, we have like manzanita, native asters, penstemons. We even have a couple Palo Verde trees, which are big out in the desert.
The garden is a growing, living symbol of a campus-wide collaboration to make Fresno State more sustainable.
Saving the world one tree at a time.
Depending on who you ask, Fresno State may not have a reputation for water conservation, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. Thomas Gaffery is the facilities operations manager at Fresno State. He says they've been tackling water conservation for years. They've installed electronic water mains that reduce leaks. They've cut down the water used for air conditioning. Plus,
we've transitioned our sprinkler heads from older outdated models that use 13 gallons a minute to newer models, some which use as low as 5 gallons per minute.
And then there's the Center for Irrigation Technology, a lab that's been advancing irrigation practices for decades. Some of their products are used on campus.
One of the ongoing initiatives is using a product called AquaSense, which actually injects organic hydrogels below the turf and helps retain water.
In April, Fresno State unveiled a plan to reduce water use by 20% in a year. But announcements like this are few and far between, so it's no surprise that the rest of campus and the community isn't always aware of what's going on. Enter the Sustainability Project, the driving force behind the WaterWise Demo Garden. Dr. Chris Wilhite is one of the project's founders. Her specialty is applied behavior and analysis, solving problems by helping people change their behaviors for the better. When she first got involved in sustainability on campus, she was surprised by what she found.
What I think is, once I got into looking at it, what we found is there is a lot more going on here than anybody knew about. The reason it wasn't known about is the people who are doing this are busy.
So her work has focused not just on individual changes, but campus-wide changes that can help the administration achieve their goals. A few years ago, one of her classes made a detailed analysis of how students use campus grounds.
And what we found is hardly anybody was sitting on the lawn. If there were tables and benches around, people were sitting on those.
The conclusion? Less grass, more seating. The demo garden will not only save water and be nice to look at, it'll have benches. Plus, it'll feature signs about the plants and how to take care of them. The Sustainability Project also recruited student volunteers, so-called sustainability ambassadors. Back in April, Cassandra Hishida and her fellow ambassadors helped put on a campus-wide Earth Day fair.
We had a great mix of vendors. The San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District was there. The Chaffee Zoo was there talking about their conservation efforts. There was the Fresno State Food Recovery Network, tons of other groups.
It was one of many efforts to improve the communication about sustainability. But Hishida says there are more obstacles to fixing up campus than a lack of awareness.
The number one challenge was the issue of being a commuter campus. Students can drive, whether it's 10 minutes or 2 hours, to and from school. They don't have a lot of time to stay on campus late and get involved.
Finding solutions to this problem is one long-term goal of the sustainability ambassadors. Challenges aside, Chris Wilhite is excited about the future of water conservation and sustainability on campus.
We have support on both the academic and the facility side. And the students, they just eat it up. We've got all those levels. So I'm very, very hopeful and optimistic.
If a few pending grants come through, the Sustainability Project plans to develop two more WaterWise gardens on campus. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. For an election expected to have a very low turnout, the June 3rd primary could play an outsized role in shaping California's political landscape. That's because of the stark ideological battle shaping up in the Republican Party between gubernatorial candidates Tim Donnelly and Neel Kashkari. Ben Adler reports from Sacramento in the second of our three-part series on the 2014 governor's race.
Tim Donnelly and Neel Kashkari couldn't be more different. Donnelly is an unapologetic Tea Party assemblyman.
It's the political power people against the people. And political parties, I could care less about. The political parties are the problem. It's the people who are the solution.
Kashkari is an intense former U.S. Treasury official who's fiscally conservative but socially moderate.
Clearly, what we've been doing has not been working. Clearly, we need a message that can bring many more voters into the Republican tent, and we need a vibrant two-party system in California.
Both men want to take on Democratic Governor Jerry Brown in November and shape the California Republican Party's brand, a party with less than 30% of registered voters. Republican Cassandra Pye was Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's deputy chief of staff. She says the Republican who takes on Brown must be inclusive.
They need to talk about being supportive of women and women's leadership, opportunities for people of color, because that's who lives here. And there also needs to be a very, very serious focus on the next generation.
Many establishment Republicans are scared about Donnelly advancing in June. He's compared illegal immigration to war and was the only assembly member to vote against a bill banning the state from selling the Confederate flag. And then there's the controversy over his campaign accusing Kashkari of submitting to Sharia law. Senate Republican leader Bob Huff fears Donnelly could cost his party seats in the legislature in a year the GOP hopes to eliminate Democrat supermajorities.
So I've endorsed Neel Kashkari as a clear indicator that he represents more the ideals and the Republican values and, frankly, the mainstream values of the districts that my Republican's running in.
Many Democrats, meanwhile, would love to see Donnelly become the face of the California Republican Party. Many, but not all.
I'm a liberal Democrat, but I'm a Californian.
That's former Assemblyman Fred Keeley. He says it's critical that Republicans nominate a credible candidate who can make the GOP relevant and moderate the Democrats in power.
But if there isn't even a viable debate, then my concern is the policy evolution on various issues, incrementally, step by step, baby step by baby step, gets out of step with California.
But Kashkari had just 2% in a recent poll, despite a wide fundraising edge. Donnelly has polled as high as 17%, thanks in large part to his visceral connection with conservatives.
And that's why Tim Donnelly is going to be the next governor of California. Yeah!
Sarah Thompson spoke at a recent Capitol rally for a Donnelly bill that would reverse the state's two-year-old ban on using dogs to hunt bears and bobcats. She recalled when she first met the assemblyman as that ban was becoming law, and Donnelly promised to overturn it.
My heart hurt so bad. All of ours did. But this man that I didn't even know made a commitment to me and to all of us. And that's when I saw it, the flame. The fire that we all have, I saw it in his eyes, and I believed him.
John Briscoe with the conservative grassroots group California Republican Assembly says only Donnelly would give voters a real choice in November.
Between a real conservative and a real liberal, as opposed to a Republican that's not totally conservative.
Briscoe points out Kashkari ran the federal government's bank bailout program, known as TARP, and voted for President Obama in 2008.
And then it's like, well, they're both the same, so we might as well vote for Brown.
In the end, it's widely assumed that most Californians will vote for Brown. But the Republican who finishes second in June could also shape the state's future. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You can compare the results of previous governors' races with political party registration statistics in those years at kvpr.org. And next week, our three-part series concludes with a look at how many California progressives are frustrated with Democratic Governor Jerry Brown. You can find all of our stories, of course, on our website, kvpr.org. With immigration reform efforts seemingly stalled in Washington, D.C., the California legislature is continuing to take its own steps to address the undocumented immigrants who call the state home. FM89's Diana Aguilera reports on one new bill that would help a variety of undocumented professionals.
In order to practice medicine, doctors have to provide a Social Security number to obtain a license from the state. This process automatically excludes undocumented immigrants from applying. But a bill that passed the state Senate earlier this month could give unauthorized immigrants that chance. The bill introduced by Senator Ricardo Lara would ease the licensing process beyond doctors. It would extend to several professions, including nurses, dentists, real estate agents, and security guards. Jessica Smith is the director of the New American Legal Clinic at San Joaquin College of Law.
I think it's indicative of a response to the lack of legislation at a federal level granting immigration benefits. And since there's been no major law that Congress has passed that's given immigration benefits to the undocumented since 2001, there is a lot of people left in limbo, including many people that were brought here young that grew up here.
Under Senate Bill 1159, about 40 state boards would accept a federal taxpayer ID number as proof of identity. The proposal has sparked an uproar from national conservative groups. William Gein is the president of the Americans for Legal Immigration Political Action Committee.
We thought it was insane and detrimental to American workers and taxpayers. We oppose it because it sends the wrong message to the rest of the world and the over 1 billion people on the planet of Earth that would probably prefer to live in America if they could get away with it. It says, come here, come to California. If you're an illegal immigrant, the state of California will aid and abet you in violation of existing federal law.
The bill passed the Senate with support from 7 Republicans. 5 GOP members abstained. Lara's proposal reflects a similar measure that was approved last year by the legislature and later signed by Governor Jerry Brown. The measure allows any immigrant to practice law despite their residency status if they are certified by the state bar. Supporters of immigration reform are applauding Lara's initiative.
I have heard of many students, even here from the Central Valley, that are studying for that, and they go to the educational system, right? And then they're not able to use all of this investment that they made in their education.
Crisanti Valencia is with the California Youth Justice Alliance.
Most of these students don't even qualify for deferred action. So this would definitely help those students to actually get that, like, a leave and have some hope in continuing their dreams.
Lara's bill is now in the Assembly. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Diana Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Back in the late 1990s, California voters passed Proposition 227, which imposed strict restrictions on bilingual education in California's public school classrooms. Supporters of the effort said English immersion was the best way for English learners to succeed and assimilate into society. Critics said by teaching core subjects only in English, non-English speakers were at a disadvantage in the classroom. That debate has simmered for 16 years, but now it's back in the news. A new bill by Senator Ricardo Lara would put a repeal of Prop 227 restrictions before voters in November of 2016. Lara says California of today is different from California of the late 1990s and that districts and parents should have more say over what types of dual language programs schools offer. That bill, SB 1174, was recently approved by the Senate Education Committee with support not only from Democrats, but also from Republican Senate Minority Leader Bob Huff. So is California really ready to change course on bilingual education? We'll hear from opponents of the Lara bill in a moment. But first, we're joined by Professor Patricia Gondara. She is a professor of education at UCLA and the co-director of the Civil Rights Project. Professor Gondara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to join you.
The issue of bilingual education in California has been one that is not without controversy going back decades. The current legislation that is in Sacramento, what would it change from where we're at right now in Sacramento and our schools?
Well, the legislation is still being developed, so I don't think we can say specifically how this will operate. But the idea is to return choice to parents and allow parents in California, without having to go through a cumbersome and oftentimes not even successful waiver process, to be able to enroll their children in a dual language or bilingual program.
What is that process like right now?
Well, right now, the default program in California is an English immersion, a structured English immersion program. And that can mean many things, but that's what it's titled. And right now, fewer than 5% of kids actually even have access to anything like a bilingual instruction. So overwhelmingly, children in California are in these English immersion programs. In order to be in a program that is not English immersion, parents can seek a waiver, and they have to go to the school, and they have to fill out forms, and then these have to be weighed by the principal and then the district, and they have to decide whether they have enough parents who want this program. And so it can be lengthy, cumbersome, and not very friendly, really, particularly to parents who aren't really savvy about how the schools operate.
Many supporters of bilingual education cite new research that suggests that bilingual instruction in public schools actually is a direct benefit or has a net benefit versus English-only immersion instruction. Can you tell me more about what your research and your analysis of that research shows us?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm delighted for the opportunity to do this because too often policies get made without paying any attention to what the research says. And even at the time that Proposition 227 passed in 1998 in California, which resulted in this virtual ban on bilingual instruction, folks simply were not paying attention to what research told us. But since that time, there has been a new generation of research that just simply affirms and extends some of the things that we already knew. And that includes recent studies that have looked at the couple of the very largest school districts, including LAUSD in California, and tracking children from kindergarten into high school to see how these children fare who have been in a consistent bilingual instruction versus those that have been in an English immersion instruction. And basically, the findings from this work, and a lot of this has been done recently under the supervision of Sean Reardon at Stanford University, findings are totally consistent that children who have been continuously in the bilingual programs are outperforming the children who have been in English immersion programs when we look at English language acquisition scores, when we look at English proficiency, and even the likelihood of being reclassified as English proficient. So on all of these important measures, the children who've had the opportunity to be in dual language or bilingual programs are doing very well. Now, that's just looking at test scores. There are many other benefits to a bilingual education, which we have known about for some time, and these include psychological benefits. It includes things even to the extent that these children who are being educated bilingually have statistically fewer behavior problems in school. They have more advanced cognitive development. There are such a host of things, and we're about to publish a book in a couple months that looks at the economic benefits. And we're finding that those young people entering the labor market who are bilingual or multilingual are going to have significant advantages in the labor market.
Going back to 1998, when Prop 227 was passed by California voters, what sort of data do we have about how education performance changed during that time? And has bilingual instruction, the thought behind it, the concepts behind it, has it also developed and changed in that time? Things in 1998 were quite different. Just look at the internet back then compared to today.
Yeah, I think that the supporters of English-only instruction like to point out that during this period in which we have had this virtual ban on bilingual instruction, English learners' scores have gone up, and they attribute that to English-only instruction. The fact of the matter is that everybody's scores went up, and the gaps did not close. So a lot of things were happening. We had class size reduction. We had we were in a, at that time we were in a period that was not so underfunded as came to be later on, and a number of additional programs were added to the schools, and it showed some impact. So all kids got a little bit better, but I think that the important message is that the gap didn't close. So with more attention, with more funding, with a somewhat smaller class size, with some targeted programs, English learners improved, but they didn't improve enough to close the gaps. And that's really an important message.
Our guest today on Valley Edition has been Patricia Gandara. She is the professor of education at UCLA and the co-director of the Civil Rights Project. Professor Gandara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And joining us now with another perspective on this issue is Cliff Colwell. He is a physician and a member of the board of the group Pro-English, which opposes the Laura bill. Mr. Colwell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Looking back to 1998 and the years that have gone by since then, how would you characterize California's experiment in rolling back bilingual education in the schools?
Well, I think it's an excellent question, and what it really looks at is what happened between the early 70s when it was mandated for bilingual education. By 1998, that social experiment, at least based on the data that was available, was not successful, and consequently the vote in that referendum, 227, was over 60% were in favor of dropping that in favor of a immersion program that's now called a structured English immersion program. But all of the data that's been published since then, there are lots of research projects going on, but all the published data would suggest that immersion has been a much more effective tool than bilingual education, and the cost of course, is immensely different. This actually cost billions of dollars between the 70s and 1998. As you're also aware, this happened quickly again in Arizona by 2000 with over 64% of the people voting for a change, and then again in Massachusetts in 2004 with over 68%. So it's been an opportunity to study this subject at great depth.
Yes, certainly. And speaking of studies, one of the ones that was mentioned by Patricia Gandara in our last segment from Professor Reardon in Stanford gives both sides a little bit of ammunition. He found in this recent study published in 2014 that in elementary school, Latino students enrolled in dual language programs were reclassified as English proficient at a slower overall rate, but then in high school, they were at a faster overall rate, so gaining there. So there's a lot of research and different things that we could look at. But turning to the Laura bill, Senator Laura talks about how California is now a different state, how having these multilingual skills is much more important for success. Do you believe that makes it more important to look at the way the state does bilingual instruction now? Do you believe that's a sound argument?
Well, I think you always should continue to look at situations because it's a moving playing field. I agree with that. But they don't discuss at all the issue of which languages. If you look at the civil rights issues here, we now have 327 languages in this country. And by civil rights, if you're going to teach in a second language, you're going to have to do that in each language. When you consider attempting to get teachers who are qualified in all these languages to teach at all schools, and that's not even considering the costs of such a program. So people focus on bilingual with just the Spanish, but you can't just do that. There's no way in the world that you can deprive anybody else then if you're going to produce it for Spanish. You're going to have to produce it for all these 327 languages. We have to do that in medicine now. You may be aware of that in the Clinton administration, a presidential order was that we had to provide language translation in medicine if you received either Medi-Cal or Medicare funding in all languages. Now, that is possible to do. It's very expensive, but it's possible. But to teach all the children in the school systems that, I just can't imagine the cost of that.
What about the issue of local control? Some people have said, why not leave it up to individual school districts? Different districts in different parts of the state may have different views on it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's already available, and I think it's a great access route if both the parents and the teachers at a specific school system decide they want to teach in a separate language, whichever one that is. They can do that right now. I agree with that totally. At a local level, you should be able to decide this. The question is, should you do either state funding? And the federal government bowed out of this completely in 2002 at the time of the No Child Left Behind Act. The federal government said, we just can't see that we're going to fund it. If the state wants to fund it, that's fine, but we're out of the funding issue for this.
Again, we've been talking with Cliff Colwell. He is a physician and a member of the board of the group Pro English, looking at bilingual education programs in California. And those test scores, do you feel that those rise in test scores are directly attributed to English immersion programs over the past years?
I believe that's the case. I believe that everything that's been published since 1998, I'm not talking about studies that are in process, but anything that's been published would favor immersion program.
All right. Again, Dr. Colwell, thank you so much for joining us. He's from the group Pro English, which opposes the Laura bill. We'll see if that winds up before California voters in November 2016, still some time away. But Dr. Colwell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition with more and our continued look at the race for the 21st Congressional District. We've already heard from David Valadao and Amanda Renteria. Now another challenger joins us, John Hernandez, next on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. The race for California's 21st congressional district is one of the most watched in the state, and for that matter, the nation. Three top candidates are vying for a shot to be among the top two finishers in the June primary in order to move on to the November general election. A few months ago, the incumbent Republican Congressman David Valadao joined us on this program to talk about the issues. And last week, Democratic challenger Amanda Renteria was our guest. Today, we talked to another candidate, Fresno Democrat John Hernandez. The president and CEO of the Fresno-based Central California Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, Hernandez is no stranger to politics. He ran for this very seat 2 years ago, defeating fellow Democrat Blong Zhang in the primary, only to lose to Valadao in November. John Hernandez joins us in the studio today. John, welcome.
Welcome. It's great to be here at Valley Public Radio.
This seat is no stranger, the race for this seat, you're no stranger to this race. In 2012, you lost to Congressman Valadao by about 15 points. Why do you think you would fare differently this year? What's changed?
Well, I think last year, the last time I ran, remember we had Senator Rubio. Senator Rubio was going to run for Congress. Then he decided in late December, early January that he was not. Then the question was Bustamante going to get in? Was Flores going to get in? I got in. Then it was, were those other two going to get in or not? Then finally Blong Zhang got in. Then we had our race and we did, and I beat Blong Zhang. And Blong Zhang, who has endorsed my candidacy also, I greatly appreciate Blong Zhang's support. And now we've had time to build more infrastructure. We've had more time to get more name recognition. And we've had more time to get more familiar with every single city in the district. And I have spent the time and put in the time to get to know what each city needs. You know, like, for instance, Fowler, they need more green space. They have some land already donated. All they need is they need infrastructure for green space. Huron, what they need is they need a high school. They are the largest city without a high school. And on top of that, they also need some more infrastructure dollars to help them clean their water. Mendota needs a bank. We need to lure a bank into Mendota. It's one of the largest cities in the region, does not have a bank. And they need more flexibility with their infrastructure dollars so they can help attract small businesses. Then you go into to Hanford and Lemoore. Lemoore wants the expansion of Lemoore Naval Air Base. That's what they're looking for. And that's something that I do support. Then we also have down in Wasco and Shafter. What they want to see that inland port, which is right there in Wasco and Shafter, that Senator Flores put in place. They want to see it expand. So those are things that we're working on right now. And Arvin, Lamont, they have terrible, terrible environmental problems that need to be addressed in both their air quality, water quality, and also infrastructure. So we have real needs throughout this district. I've had time to study it. And Delano, they have the worst, some of the worst water problems in the state in Delano too. So they need help with their water.
Your opponent, Amanda Renteria, is a native of the Valley, but she spent most of her professional career away in places like Washington, D.C. Does that make it harder for someone to understand the issues facing people here or maybe an outside perspective? How do you feel you compare with your Democratic opponent in terms of understanding the Valley?
Understanding the Valley, I think it's a hands down. There's no contest there. Amanda's a good person. I like her personally. But I think she's really out of touch. She's out of touch with what's really happening in the Valley. Everything is grandiose types of talk, blanket talk. I'm talking about specifics. You know, that's what we're talking about. Sanger, they were going to sell their Sanger Park. You know, I was there to help them keep that park. In Hanford, they were going to sell Hidden Valley Park. I was there to help push that back to where they keep green space in Hanford. Those are little things that really do matter to voters. And I think that's where I really do connect with the voters quite a bit better than Amanda does. You know, like I said, Amanda's a good person. I like her personally. But I think she really is not as close to the ground, on the ground, knowing the details like I do.
You mentioned infrastructure projects. High-speed rail is certainly one that promises to create jobs in Central California. It's also very controversial. Your opponent, Congressman Valadao, has been a staunch critic of the project. I'll ask the same question to you that I asked of Amanda Renteria last week. Is there some point where this project simply becomes too expensive? We saw the price tag go up 2 weeks ago by another $1 billion, in this case the Fresno to Bakersfield section. Amanda Renteria was somewhat cautious on her stance on high-speed rails. Where do you stand on it? Is this something that you still support at this point with the escalating price tag?
Well, I think high-speed rail is really a ticket for this valley to the future. I strongly support high-speed rail, but I do have the ability to promote aggressive oversight of the project. That's something that I can do because I have a personal relationship with those people that are on the high-speed rail authority. I know them. I know Diane Gomez personally. I know President Morales. We worked with them for years and years and years at the Central California Hispanic Chamber of Commerce because what I see is the ability for our small business community. We fought tooth and nail for those small business opportunities over the years, whether it be – I attended over 26 different high-speed rail forums up and down the state of California. And fighting for those local jobs is important. That's why we got in the 10% local participation from the higher people. And then also we got the 30%. Now, 30% of this $6 billion that's coming in, that's a big chunk of money if you think about it. And we got a 30% small business participation goal out of that. And now it's our job and would be my job if I'm the congressman to make sure that the High-Speed Rail Authority meets those goals of 30% small business participation and 10% higher local. We need to make sure that they follow up on those. And that's really thousands and thousands of jobs. Then we also have the high-speed rail maintenance station that will be somewhere here in the valley. But I'm already looking past that towards the factory that will build the machines, the high-speed rail machines, because it's not just going to happen here in California then stop. It's going to go across the nation. So I just see a good opportunity for small business participation. Also, I see a good opportunity for middle-class jobs, and that's something we're highly lacking. And also, we need to keep in mind that the future needs and travel needs of our valley and our state of California is not going to – they're not going to diminish. We can only build so many highway lanes. We can only build so many airports. This will help relieve some of the congestion out of those, and it costs half the price of building new airports and new roads.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is John Hernandez. He's a Fresno Democrat who's running for office in California's 21st Congressional District. He is challenging Republican incumbent David Valadao and also Democratic newcomer Amanda Renteria. The top two candidates in the June election move on to the November general election. It seems like there's not a Valley politician out there who would say they are against water or against agriculture. But when it comes to the current situation that farmers in the Valley are facing, Republicans in Congress have been very aggressive in pursuing an approach to ease pumping in the Delta, restrictions regarding the Endangered Species Act to bring more water from north to south and ease some of the pain, whether in this drought year or in general years. Where do you stand on relaxing those restrictions and maybe weakening the protections on the smelt and salmon?
Well, I'll tell you this. We have a serious water problem in the state of California, and it's not only here. It's all across the nation. I strongly support us making sure we have the ability to make sure that the water, you know, because every so many years we have a wet year. We need to have that capacity to store that water. The current water system that we have in the state of California is really built for about 28 million people. We already have 36. We're heading towards 40, and then we'll be at 50 million people. We need to make sure that we have a water system that is, A, up to date. I think when you look at the Delta, we have outside of the fish and the aqua, you know, all that, we also have the dikes in the Delta are very, very fragile. Those need attention. We need to make sure that if a major earthquake happens, that our water supply does not get contaminated. That's why we need to upgrade our entire water system. It's not just about the Delta. It's not just about the building new storage or underground storage or Tule Lake, restoring that or whatever that might be. We have a variety of problems here that we have to solve. And some flexibility, I think Dianne Feinstein has led on this issue a little bit and made some flexibility. But the real problem we have, though, is we don't have enough water. And what we need to do is practice what they're doing on the west side. I was on a tour of the west side, and I was looking at the desalinization process they have. Desalinization is a viable alternative to help us increase the amount of water that we have. And what they're doing is they're reusing that water. The water goes in, gets put in the system. They collect it into the crop, and then they put it through again. So we have water that's been used 6, 7, 8 times, 10 times, the same water. And that's how we really do, some dynamic ideas to help us stretch our water. That's what we really need to do. Conservation is a part of it. Additional storage is a part of it. Underground storage is a part of it. So we really do have a multifaceted approach. But definitely, we need more infrastructure. That's the key.
One of the other big issues that's of importance to so many here in the Valley and throughout the country is immigration reform. The efforts to bring a bill to a vote in the House have not been successful so far this year. Right now, the House is led by Republicans. That could change in November. But right now, the issue of immigration reform, a comprehensive bill versus an opportunity to vote on a piecemeal approach, taking one element of the immigration puzzle at a time. Would you support a piecemeal approach if that was the only way to bring about immigration reform in Congress if elected?
I won't vote for any type of bill that does not include a path to citizenship. I'll leave it at that. The current bill that is in Congress has a path to citizenship. And let's also make it clear right here is that Valadao, Congressman Valadao, supports the bill that has a path to citizenship. But he also supports the bill that doesn't have a path to citizenship. I'm saying path to citizenship. If he supports a path to citizenship, drop the support for the other bill. The other bill only gives green cards. It does not give citizenship. We need a path to citizenship just like we did, because whenever you're listening to talk radio, it's Ronald Reagan's our hero. Ronald Reagan is the guy who did everything, apparently, right? Well, he did do a lot. He passed Social Security reform, and he also passed immigration reform. And he did have a path to citizenship that is actually called amnesty. This is a little different. A lot of people say, well, what is a path to citizenship? You're cutting in the line. No, that's not what we're doing here. What we're doing here is you're going to the end of the line like everybody else. You're paying a fine. You're learning English. And you're passing your citizenship test just like anybody else does. I am a little concerned about the time frame in this current bill of 10 years. It is a long time. The reason why is if it was a shorter time frame, we would experience the economic impact of immigration reform, which in 1986 had a $2 trillion impact on our economy. We could experience that now as opposed to, or the next couple of years as opposed to over 10 years.
Our guest today on Valley Edition has been Fresno Democrat John Hernandez. He is running for office in California's 21st Congressional District. He's facing off against Republican incumbent David Valadao and Democratic challenger Amanda Renteria. John Hernandez, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure.
And stay tuned. We have more on the way on Valley Edition with author Gary Noy in his new book, Sierra Stories, Hidden History in Our Midst, in the mountains to our east. That's coming up straight ahead here on Valley Edition.
Every day is an opportunity to learn something new. And on public radio, you experience voices, sounds, and ideas that you won't hear elsewhere. It's radio that respects your intelligence and goes beyond headlines and sound bites to give you the whole story.
Members make public radio possible. Become one today. It's an investment in your brain. Click donate at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's hard to imagine life in the San Joaquin Valley without the Sierra Nevada. While smog and dust often serves to obscure the view from the valley floor, this majestic mountain range plays a major role in our lives. It's not just home to internationally renowned gems like Yosemite, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon National Parks. It's also a place that's rich in its own human history. A new book seeks to share many of those moments. It's called Sierra Stories, Tales of Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. And its author, Gary Noy of Sierra College in Rockland, joins us on Valley Edition right now. Gary, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
How did this book come about? These are short stories that you've compiled together of a variety of different people, different eras that all center in the Sierra Nevada. How did the idea come about?
Well, it came about really when it started when I was a little kid. I'm a Sierra Nevada kid. I was born in Grass Valley up in Nevada County. And ever since I was very little, I was always fascinated by the stories of the Sierra Nevada and in particular the unusual lesser-known stories. And part of that I owe to my parents because they came to the Sierra where they met and had me in Grass Valley from elsewhere. My mom came from Oklahoma and my dad was part of a gold mining family, a Cornish gold mining family from Montana. And so they were very interested in their new home. And so we traveled around all of the places there was. And ever since I was very little, I've always been fascinated by these kind of hidden corners and stories that were in the shadows.
And you touch upon many of them in this new book, ones that go all the way back to the Gold Rush era to the present day. I want to talk about some of the people. The subtitle of the book sort of piques one's interest, Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. There's sort of an interesting sort of person that was drawn to the Sierra Nevada, was there not?
I think so. I think one of the primary themes in virtually all of the stories, and this book is only a handful of the thousands of stories that are out there, I think there's a kind of an overarching theme. And I think the people who came to the Sierra, most of them, came here to lose themselves, to lose their past in particular. People who came during the Gold Rush or in the years afterwards came for a new start, a rebirth, or a reinvention of their life. And so many of the stories reflect that, and I have the greatest respect for these folks who did this because they were going to an unknown place, to an unknown fate. And these stories have always fascinated me because basically that was my parents' story too. And so I think the stories reflect that kind of a basic theme.
One of the most colorful ones is that of Eliza Gilbert. Tell us about her.
Eliza Gilbert was an entertainer who clearly reinvented herself because she was born in Europe and Ireland and reinvented herself as Lola Montez, as a Spanish aristocrat. And if you read her biography, she came from grinding poverty and then all of a sudden reinvented herself as the Spanish aristocrat who ultimately had a huge influence on European history. She became the mistress of Franz Liszt and King Ludwig I of Bavaria. And through her efforts and the scandal related to her, it ultimately led to the fall of the Bavarian monarchy and ushered in a whole series of revolutions in Europe that transformed the political structure in that world. And she was, in a way, she was kind of the scandalous figure of the time period, the Lindsay Lohan of the 1840s. And she ultimately escaped that, came to America as an entertainer, who became famous or infamous for a kind of strange version of the tarantella dance that she called the spider dance, where she was being attacked by a legion of spiders. And she became kind of a figure of fun and derision and ultimately moved to my hometown, which is Grass Valley, where she lived kind of in obscurity for a while and then kind of drifted off into history. But she's very typical of the kind of person who reinvented themselves and came to this part of the world, to the Sierra, to find a new start, a new way forward.
In the section, Just to Prove a Point, you write about the people who found these impossibly large trees, the giant sequoias, and then they cut them down so they could dance on the largest stump in the world. That's quite a window into the mindset of the person who came to the Sierra as well, is it not?
I think so. I think it's a very typical 19th century viewpoint, in particular, that people came to this part of the world to experience a brand new landscape. And yet, in the mid-19th century in particular, there was a belief that humans could conquer nature. And so they took this giant sequoia, this is in the Calaveras Big Trees, and they took 3 weeks to cut it down just to prove that they could. And then they polished off the stump and made it into a dance floor. And John Muir famously wrote about this in his 1901 book, Our National Parks, in which he decried this desecration of this beautiful organism. And then the fallen part of the tree, they turned into a bowling alley and into a kind of an observatory office that they put a building over the part of the stump. They had a part of the fallen tree that they put a ladder up, and you could pay a nickel or a few cents to climb up to the top of this fallen monarch. And it became kind of a symbol of the exploitation and viewpoint toward nature that was rampant during the mid-19th century and which I believe is gone now, thankfully.
Race factors into a number of the stories that you tell as well, from the story of the Japanese internment in Manzanar to the Chinese exclusion laws to African American soldiers in Yosemite. Tell me a little more about how you see race as an issue in the Sierra throughout the centuries.
Well, I think it's part of the entire collective historical journey that we've gone through to get to this a particular moment in time. And sometimes the road is smooth and level and beautiful, and sometimes it's very, very steep and rough and terrible and horrifying, and it's all part of the experience. And sadly, in Sierra Nevada history, the most hidden aspects of our history have to do with race relations. So to understand the context and the texture and the nuance of our Sierra experience, you have to talk about the darker, very troubling episodes. And so I address those in the book, and I think it helps us understand the journey that we've gone through to this point. It's a troubling history, but we've come a long, long way from those days, and even in the darkest moments, there were rays of light in which people demonstrated kindness toward each other, or remarkable stories came out of it, such as with the Japanese Americans. The development of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team of Japanese-American volunteers from the camps, who became the most decorated military unit of its size and duration of service in the history of the United States Army, in the history of military service in the United States. An extraordinary story. And so I think, you know, it factors in importantly in helping us understand how we've gotten to this point in time. I think it's part of the journey.
There's also a very rich engineering legacy. You talk about it in several instances from Theodore Judah and the Truckee Incline to Tioga Pass Road. Tell me about the amazing engineering feats that you document in this book.
Well, it's the Tioga Pass Road is just a rollicking adventure because it's essentially the story deals with the eastern end leading down toward Lee Vining. And how it came to be known as the Terrible Tioga, because it was so rough and so dangerous that even to this day, that part of the pass, the Yosemite National Park recommends that you not even hike there, but yet there's a road there, and it's much safer and nicer today. But in the beginning, it was very, very dangerous. And another story that a number of people have commented on to me is the story of Andrew Hallady, and who was the father of the cable car system in San Francisco, but had his start building suspension bridges during the Gold Rush period, sprinkled throughout the gold country in the Sierra. And it was there that he experimented with what he called wire rope, what we call metal cable today, which becomes the basis for a continuous loop for a ski lift or for the cable cars. And so there is an influential legacy in terms of engineering, in terms of the railroad and mining techniques and things like Halliday's ropeway, as he called it, that still influence us today.
I want to close with one of the more contemporary stories. You talk about some of the pioneering mountain climbers, free climbers, and others in Yosemite National Park, even in recent times. Do you see some commonalities between them today and their predecessors years ago, pioneers in the Sierra, over 150 years ago?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I think it's all part of the same continuum. I mean, if you look at the stories, if you go back to, for instance, George Anderson, who's considered to be the first human to scale Half Dome, all the way up to Alex Honnold today, who's kind of the contemporary rock star, as they call him in some newspapers, of climbing. They all have the same kind of adventurous spirit, this kind of go for broke, putting aside their own personal safety in order to accomplish extraordinary goals. And they all use the same kind of equipment that has, through time, transformed and improved to the degree where, you know, we look at the very sophisticated climbing equipment today compared to the hobnailed boots that John Muir wore, for instance. And we think they're different, but it's just kind of a continuum based upon the same basic concept, which is just start climbing, hang on, and hope. And it's reflected in the spirit of these climbers today that I think is just a continuous thread all through our history in the Sierra.
Again, our guest today is Gary Noy. He is the author of the new book, Sierra Stories, Tales of Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. It's available on Heyday Books, wherever better books are sold. Mr. Noy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, it's time to say goodbye for another edition of Valley Edition. Let us know what you think about the show. You can email us talk@kvpr.org, or you can send us a tweet @kvpr. For Valley Edition reporter Deanna Aguilera, reporter and producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.